It's true. Yes, I am writing a commentary on Esther. And so when Bob asked for me to stand in, well, how could I refuse? And this gives me a chance to test out some material. What I saw, it sounds like the class, the title is Esther and Politics. I don't quite know how that's working, but I'm not really going to get into politics a lot. Although I do think what I want to talk about today has some relevance for Christians in society and has some political implications, but that's not really the focus. I better get a clock where I can see it. I'll begin with the white bear problem. Some of you may know about that. Don't think about a white bear. Now, what are you all thinking about right now? A white bear, right. This is a psychological, I'm a psychologist, study this. It's a thing known as ironic process theory, if you want a very highfalutin term. And it's when you're deliberately trying to suppress certain thoughts, it makes them more likely to surface. So when you're trying to not think about something, you wind up thinking about it, like white bears, or it could be anything, pink elephants, or I don't know why it's all animals, but this syndrome, whatever you want to call it, it actually has a lot to do with the book of Esther, because you've probably heard, I don't know how far into the book of Esther you are, but usually the first thing you hear about the book of Esther is it never mentions one person, and who's that? God. See, you've got a good teacher. The book never mentions God. In fact, it goes out of its way to avoid talking about Him or doing anything that might point to God when it has the opportunity. Just to give you a quick example of that in Esther 4. And by the way, I'm just going to assume, as we go along here, that you know all about the book of Esther, that you've read the book of Esther, you're kind of familiar with it. Also, that you know your whole Bible, you're kind of familiar with that. So have the Bible open so you can flip around, just in case I say something that you're not as up on. But in Esther chapter 4, that's a crucial chapter in the book of Esther. Important things happen throughout. But in Esther chapter 4, Mordecai, Esther's uncle, sort of adopted uncle, or adopted father, really, is speaking to her and urging her to go to visit her husband, the king, because apparently she needs an appointment for that. And she says, well, I want you to summon all the Jews here in Susa, the capital city, and fast, and then I will go and visit, I'll go see the old man. And the thing is, she says, I want you to fast for me. In the Bible, almost every time somebody talks about fasting, they talk about something else. Fasting and prayer. It doesn't mention it there. That's actually very unnatural in the Old Testament. Anytime a person fasts, it's for the purpose of praying. So it's like the author is trying hard to not say anything like prayer, which is talking to God, right? Fasting, well, you know, okay, that could be because you're on one of those weird diets or something like that. I wasn't meaning to look at you. Sorry. Anyway, let's not go there. That's an example of how the author is trying hard to not mention God, but it's so kind of over the top, and it's that way throughout the book. Any point where you could have mentioned God or mentioned something that points to God, like prayer, no mention of it. And so it's one of those things that virtually any commentary on the book of Esther talks about this. You know, it doesn't mention God. There's no religious stuff in it. So it seems like a very secular book. And part of the point is that I think the author's trying to do is by avoiding it, it's like he's trying to say, don't think about God. And so what do you start doing? You start thinking about, well, how's God in this story? That's part of the way the book of Esther is rolling. So it's actually trying to encourage us to think about God by avoiding talking about Him at every possible place. That's one reason. That's one thing that's going on in the book of Esther. The other thing that is going on here is that part of the reason why it doesn't mention God, the book of Esther doesn't mention God, is because it's trying to depict a world in which God seems absent. And maybe Bob's talked about this already, but I think this is part of what's going on in the book. It's just trying to give you a picture of a world where God seems distant. He doesn't seem to be... He's not appearing in clouds and fire and casting the Egyptians into the Red Sea and doing dramatic things like that. He just seems to be gone. Well, let's think about that. The idea that God seems absent. You'll hear this sort of thing all the time, actually, from people who are skeptics of the faith, cynics, atheists, and so on. You know, where was God when, you know, insert disaster, you know, number 27, you know, on 9/11, where was God then? The idea is, if God really existed, why didn't he do something about it? 9/11 is a big one. Or you could mention, you know, think of all sorts of other disastrous occurrences. This is interesting. My family will know this because I mentioned it in a sermon a few weeks ago. In May 2016, there, an Israeli news source, The Times of Israel, ran this story, and it was under the headline, "Man Seeks Restraining Order Against God." That's got to be a good story, so I had to read it. But it was good. It was worth it. It began like this. "An Israeli man has petitioned the Haifa Magistrates Court for a restraining order against God, claiming the Almighty has been particularly unkind to him." The Almighty, you know, seeking a restraining order against the Almighty. Just ponder that one for a bit. The reporter here clearly was enjoying this story and clearly found it humorous. And you can tell from the way that they were writing it up, because the reporter goes on. "A protocol of the hearing noted that God did not turn up for the session, although it did not specify how the court determined the omnipresent was not in fact there, as opposed to merely exercising the right to remain silent." There's a serious point to that, which is that sometimes God does exercise the right to remain silent. Beg pardon? Well, it was good. But it was a legit story. I don't know about the story. There's a lot of other funny stuff in it, like when he called, he complained that, you know, all the cops did was, you know, send a cruiser around to check things out. Anyway. Sometimes God exercises the right to remain silent, and that is what one thing we see going on in the book of Esther. He's exercising that right, and so you don't see him, you know, sending prophets. You don't see him, again, appearing in clouds and smoke and, you know, voice thundering like on Mount Sinai and that sort of thing. It's very quiet. And, you know, sometimes skeptics, unbelievers will throw this sort of thing out. But let's remember that actually believers will experience this as well. Like, read the book of Psalms and think about how many times the psalmist, you know, "Oh Lord, where are you? Why do you stand far off? Why aren't you listening to me? Why are you keeping silent?" Just start with not Psalm 1, but you don't have to get very far before you start hearing expressions like that. So the point being that even believers, people of faith, Christian faith, they will also experience this idea that God just seems absent. And, you know, I believe that he exists and that sort of thing. But, you know, in terms of how it's, what good is it in my life? He doesn't seem to be here. He's not helping me through this time or that sort of thing. So it's a sentiment, it's a feeling that unbelievers and believers experience. So that's partly why I think the book of Esther is really a very powerful book, because God seems absent. That's something that everybody should be able to relate to at some point in their lives. Now, when we think about the book of Esther and What's its big message? What's it trying to get across? There are a few lessons that scholars, commentators will talk about, and some I think are well understood. It's a book that teaches God's providence very clearly. The idea that, you know, God's in control of everything. He's orchestrating circumstances and events for good. I won't kind of go through them all, but if you look in chapters 5 and 6 of the book, there's just this string of all of these improbable circumstances conspire together in just the perfect way that in the end God's people get delivered. There's this death decree hanging over them, starting in chapter 3 of the book. You hopefully know all that Haman, the bad guy, he's able to get to win over the king's confidence, and so he passes this decree where we get to slaughter the Jews in the kingdom of Persia, the empire. That's hanging out there, and things look bad. Eventually, of course, in the end, they're delivered, but things look bad. How do they get delivered? Well, it's this very improbable chain of events, and especially in chapters 5 and 6, you see these things just interlocking so incredibly. Like the king, in a very unlikely turn of events, has insomnia on this one particular night. And, he doesn't turn on the TV. There were no TVs back then. Doesn't check his email. Bring me the Royal Chronicles. I want to hear Royal Chronicles. Okay, that might make sense. That might be the sort of thing that normally puts a person to sleep. Yeah. Gross national product of last year. Trade embargoes. Okay, great. What do they read about? Well, they read about how Mordecai saved the king years before. And, guess what? He never got rewarded. It just so happened that that's what they flipped to when they opened up the Royal Chronicles. They started reading about Mordecai, the hero. Yeah, I mean, go figure. Who'd have thunk it? That's what happened. They asked his assistants the question, what did we do to reward Mordecai? Well, nothing, actually. What? He saved my life and we never rewarded him. We got to fix that. Well, bring me one of my counselors. Who's in the court? Guess who just walked in? Haman, the bad guy. And, all this these improbable chains of events, it's so intricate that you have to look at it and go, that's not accidental. God had to be working all of these events together perfectly, because if one little thing fell out of place, this whole thing falls apart and then the Jews wind up slaughtered. That's a big theme in the book of Esther, and that's kind of the idea of providence, right? That God is working behind events to bring about His will, even though it doesn't seem dramatic and miraculous the way we read about elsewhere in Scripture. So providence is a big lesson of the book of Esther. The idea that we need to live faithfully and boldly sometimes, and this is really one of the key verses that people often focus on, chapter 4, verse 14. Here's Mordecai talking to Esther. You need to go to your husband. You need to intercede for your people. And he says, "For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you've not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." That's a key verse in the book of Esther. Probably Bob's already talked about it. It's just saying, Esther, Esther, you need to take bold action here. Don't shrink back. God's, deliverance will arise. Doesn't say, God will save His people, but again, we're thinking God will have to save His people. You need to be faithful, you need to be bold sometimes, and all that sort of thing. So, those are two big lessons, providence, the need to be faithful in the midst of, danger and whatnot. There's another lesson that I want to focus on, and if I get through this introductory stuff, I'll finally start talking about it. The point I want to bring out this morning is this, and I'm going to throw out a couple of words that may sound like code words to you, so I will explain what they are, but just bear with me. Esther is really about transforming the exile of God's people to the diaspora. Okay, Esther is about transforming exile into diaspora. Okay, I've just thrown out two big terms, exile and diaspora. What's the exile? You all should know this. All right, well then. They were kicked out. They were sent out, driven out of the land, the Israelites, right? They're in the promised land. There's a king. Life seems to be good, but what happens? Why were they kicked out? Becoming too... A threat? Not that so much. They were unfaithful. There, that's enough. That's good enough. They were unfaithful. Now we have to understand that. I don't really want to get too far into this, but in the Bible, there's sin and then there's sin, if I can put it that way. I mean, there's the sort of sins that people just fall into every day, like getting mad and yelling at your kids or. Being greedy, being selfish, there's that sort of thing. And, we're convicted by the Spirit of God, we repent, claim the blood of Christ, anew, and all those sorts of things. There's sins that we repent of. There's another category of sin where you are just turning away sort of definitively from God. It's called apostasy is one of the terms for it. The Bible calls it the sin unto death, the sin against the Holy Spirit. That's in a different category, where here we are, you're God, one of God's people, but you are kind of definitively rejecting Him, even though you know the truth. It's turning your back on Him. So there's that kind of climactic sin of apostasy, and the Bible warns us about this multiple places. The book that really speaks about it most powerfully in the Old Testament, or one of the books, would be the book of Deuteronomy. If you look at Deuteronomy 28 sometime, let me just encourage you to read it. It's encouraging and terrifying at the same time, because it's this long, it's a warning against turning away from the Lord. And one of the things he says there is that, look, if you turn your back, if you kind of stop listening to me, if you stop believing in me, if you finally turn your backs on me, I'm going to start, sending punishments, judgments against you to try to wake you up, Come to your senses, would you? And these punishments just get worse and worse. And really the climactic one is I will send in a foreign nation. They will attack you, take you into exile, and you'll be thrown out of the land. Deuteronomy 28, other places in Deuteronomy. Well, that's what happened in 586 or so B.C. The Babylonians came in. And so, the Babylonian exile is a term that hopefully you're familiar with. You can read about it in 2 Kings 25. So, the Lord prophesied this. He promised this would happen if the people proved to be just completely unfaithful to Him, which they did. And as part of that, He said, I'm going to drive you out of the land. I'm going to scatter you. And this is where we get this other term, diaspora. That's what the term means. It's a scattering. So when during the Babylonian exile, really the majority of God's people lived outside of the promised land. They lived in Babylon or taken elsewhere. So most of God's people not living in Judea at that time. This term diaspora, it's important because it then later became applied, a term that was applied to just Jewish communities living throughout the kind of Mediterranean world, or really anywhere outside of Israel. It could be in Greece, could be in Rome, Ethiopia, and so on. So the term you get is I never know where to put the accent on it. Diasporic? Anyone? All right, nobody knows. So, diasporic, there. Diasporic Jews, Jews of the diaspora. And that's the situation we encounter in New Testament times, actually. There are a whole lot of Jewish communities all over the Mediterranean world. There were, you know, there were Jews who lived in Israel, in Judea, yes, so they're kind of native-born, you know, born and raised here. But then, as Paul's traveling around, he's running into Jewish communities all over the place, in Galatia and Cappadocia and Cappuccino and all that. All right, so that's this concept of diaspora, is this scattering, okay? So, talked about exile, talked about scattering. The Lord also prophesied that eventually he would regather his people if they turned back to him, if they circumcised their hearts, and so on. And you find that in Deuteronomy 30, for example. The Lord promises restoration. You find it prophesied in Jeremiah, especially. Jeremiah says after 70 years, Jeremiah is into the 70-year number. And so in Jeremiah 25, Jeremiah 29, he says, after 70 years, I will gather you back, you know, from the nations. And, well, we see that fulfilled, at least partially, in 539 B.C., when the Persians come in, the Persian Empire, which is on the rise, they overthrow Babylon, and the king, Cyrus, issues this decree that, you know, the Jews were allowed to return to their homeland. He actually made this decree about all sorts of subjugated peoples in his empire. He was, for the day, he was a nice guy. I use that term very relatively, but yeah, he had a more benevolent policy towards some of these subjugated groups, so, you know, which include the Jews of the day. So, you know, that was nice. And so you see this happening. You see the Jews starting to return to their land. And that's, you primarily read about that in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, okay, which are set in around the same time frame as the book of Esther. It's an important theme. I'm actually preaching through Ezra and Nehemiah now in my church, and I'll get to Esther after that. So this is what you see, is the people returning and trying to rebuild their lives in the promised land. Okay, well, that's great. But what about the people, what about all those Jews who decided not to return? Who just kept living in Babylon or Persia or Egypt and that sort of thing? What are they, chopped liver or something? Because that was the reality. Not everybody returned. And we need to think about that. Were they wrong to keep living in Babylon? Or were they wrong to live in Greece? Was it their obligation to return to Judea? I'm not going to answer that question for you. The book of Esther is kind of addressing the situation of those people, because when we read the book of Esther, it's just set in Persia. There's one reference to Jerusalem. It's kind of, you get it really fast in chapter 2. And the book of Esther, you don't see people kind of standing around bemoaning, you know, I hate living here in Persia. Food's awful, and you know, people are mean, and blah, 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 blah. There's this community there that they seem to be settled in. In fact, if you think about, if you can think about Jeremiah 29, where the Lord had promised to restore his people, he also said, when you're in Babylon, you know what, kind of settle down, plant gardens and vineyards, and, you know, get your children marrying off and, you know, continuing things. But the Lord's really telling them, you're going to settle down for a while. And some people did, and then when this decree of Cyrus came in 539, probably some of them thought, well, you know, I kind of like it here. I like falafel and stuff like that. And the coffee, you know. Whew. Okay, so what I want to kind of set up here is that Ezra, you've heard Dr. Rayburn talk about the poles of Scripture, right? Kind of these contrasting ideas or themes. That's the way it is with Ezra and Nehemiah on the one hand and Esther on the other. Because Ezra and Nehemiah, the emphasis is Let's get back into the promised land. Let's rebuild things. Let's rebuild the temple. Let's rebuild the city. And Esther, those things are not a concern. We're just living in Persia. We're just trying to deal with life there. And if you really compare and contrast those books, Ezra and Nehemiah on the one hand and Esther, the contrast, it's astounding. So, for example, a big theme in Ezra and Nehemiah is we need to rebuild the temple. And so they go through all of this process of rebuilding it. The book of Esther, there's no temple. We're in Persia. No talk about the temple. They're just somehow learning to live with life without a temple and the sacrifices and that sort of thing. Or in Ezra and Nehemiah, the relationship between the Jews, God's people of the day, and the Gentiles, in Ezra and Nehemiah, the whole approach is we got to separate. If you know Ezra and Nehemiah, a big problem there is intermarriage. And at one point, the leaders even say, you know what, you know, Jewish guys, if you married some foreign woman, you got to send her away. That's dramatic stuff. Well, let's think about the lead character of the book of Esther. She's married to a goy. That's a term for a Gentile. She's married to a Gentile. You know, over here, you know, in Ezra and Nehemiah, we're trying to kind of end those relationships. You know, we need separation. Whereas in Esther, this is just the situation we're in. Our lead character, the star of the show, she's married to a Gentile king, who's kind of a buffoon, actually, but that's for another day. So Ezra and Nehemiah, it's all about we got to separate from the Gentiles. Esther, people are just dealing with the fact that, look, we're scattered, we're here in this pagan culture, and how are we going to deal with it? And so they're kind of working within the system. We need to do this without compromising. That's what's going on in the book of Esther. And what's fascinating to me about Esther is that through this process, one thing we see, and you don't see this anywhere else in the Old Testament. All right, I'm 99% certain of that statement. But I'm pretty sure it's good. In the book of Esther, this is the only place where we see mass conversions of Gentiles to the biblical faith, to the God of the Bible. Don't believe me? Elsewhere in the Old Testament, you'll see a few people converting. Well, there's Ruth the Moabitess. There's Rahab the prostitute. She was a Canaanite woman, not Jewish. There's Naaman the Syrian in 2 Kings chapter 5. There was the old Uriah the Hittite. He was a Hittite. And probably a few others. But they're all these individuals here and there. You get to the book of Esther. This is fascinating to me. You should pull this one up. Chapter 8, verse 17. This is after all of the drama basically has gone down. Not entirely, but you know, things are going in the right direction. The Jews are not going, it becomes evident, they're not going to be wiped out. In verse 17, chapter 8, it says, "In every province and every city, wherever the king's command and his edict reached, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday, and many from the peoples of the country declared themselves Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen on them." That's an incredibly important statement. Here are Gentiles, Persians or whatever, Elamites. And they're saying, you know what, we want to be associated with this people. Not bad. And that would go along with that, would go, you know, we're going to follow their religious rites, worship their God, and that sort of thing. That's implied. Also, if you look in chapter 9, verse 27, where it's talking about the festival of Purim, which has been instituted to commemorate all this stuff. The Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them. So you have this idea of, you know, a lot of people have decided, hey, there's something special about these people. I want to be with them. And so they start associating with them. You know, they declare themselves to be Jews. So you've got, again, large-scale conversion to the biblical faith going on. That's the only place, I think, that you actually see it historically playing out. The prophets, you know, they foresaw this sort of thing. You know, they said, you know, all the earth's going to be filled with the glory, knowledge of the glory of the Lord, and so on. So there was this promise, this prophecy, you know, all throughout the Old Testament, but you don't actually read about it occurring until the book of Esther. So you keep an eye on that. Because of that, I like to think of Esther as the most New Testament book of the Old Testament, because in the New Testament, that's where the mission to the nations becomes front and center. And Esther is trying to get us there. So so here's the point. Here's the point. The book of Esther is trying to do is it's trying to reshape the thinking of God's people. So these people who have been in exile, and it's trying to get them to think about that in a different way. Yes, you've been, a couple generations ago, you all got sent out of your promised land, scattered. That was an act of judgment, and that's bad. But here you are now, kind of scattered around, and here's this, the Jewish community in Persia. Maybe it's not such a bad thing to be living here. Maybe God can actually work through you, to protect you, to deliver you. Maybe He can actually work through you to convert Gentiles. And so this is part of what the book of Esther is trying to do. It's trying to change the people's mindset from kind of a, woe is us mentality, and start to think about, there are actually opportunities in this situation that you find yourselves in. There can be some advantages to being in this scattered state where you're not sort of centered entirely around this one physical location in Jerusalem. That's where I began. The book is trying to transform this idea of exile into diaspora, getting God's people to think that, this scattering, it's maybe not all a bad thing. And maybe, I'm saying maybe, I'm actually saying this is true. God can work through you. He will work through you. Yes, you need to be faithful and so on. Yes, ma'am. Well, you're welcome. I just never know what kind of comments you're going to get. I still remember, it was Rebecca Hinman, like the first Sunday school I ever taught here with the youth. I mean, I hadn't gone to seminary. I went through this whole thing on the attributes of God. She raises her hand and, yes, Rebecca. Well, I've got a question. It's not quite on the topic here. Well, okay. Do women have to wear head coverings? I didn't know enough then to say, I'm not going to. The questions need to be on topic. So, I've had this fear ever since. What's going to get asked? All right, let me draw a few applications, and then I'll try to give some time for questions. But I see a lot of parallels between the book of Esther and our situation today in the church. I think we are in a diaspora state. The church is. We're scattered throughout the nations. And in some places, the church has been stronger, either historically or just in terms of contemporary church life. In some places, it's going gangbusters. Go to South Korea, and the Presbyterians are just huge there. Go to Europe and not so much, right? Once, it was Christendom, the church was everywhere, and it's fallen on hard times there. We could argue about, what's the state in America, and I don't really want to spend a lot of time on that, but just as a generalization, I would say the church is in a scattered mode of existence. And I think Esther has a lot to encourage us with as far as that goes, that it's not necessarily a bad thing that, yeah, we feel kind of isolated maybe, or we're not this strong power block in society, the way we were at the Founding Fathers and whatever, or in Western Europe and that sort of thing. But God can still work through that. He will protect His people, as chapter 4, verse 14 says, relief will arise, deliverance will arise for God's people. That's a given. You should, that should be your guiding assumption. God will deliver His people. We may have to go through a lot of rough stuff sometimes, but He's going to deliver His people ultimately. And I think the fact that there's not this one central sanctuary any longer, it actually makes it easier for us to point to the heavenly sanctuary. You think of the book of Hebrews, and it's making the point that, look, this whole temple in Jerusalem was really just pointing to gospel realities. Christ's work for us, entering into the heavenly sanctuary, offering Himself, and so on. It's a lot easier, actually, to point to that than to have to kind of work it through either a temple in Jerusalem, or if St. Peter's in Rome, or if you're Eastern Orthodox, Hagia Sophia in, I would say Constantinople, but it's actually Istanbul, because it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. But you don't have these kind of physical centers on earth that you have to arrange things around. And we can kind of point more immediately, more directly to Christ's work in the heavenly sanctuary. I think that's actually a good thing. As much as I like cathedrals and all those sorts of things, any cathedrals, any church is meant to be pointing beyond itself. And so the fact that there isn't a physical, central, earthly sanctuary, as there was in the Old Testament, is actually an advantage. That's an advantage of this diaspora state that we're in. I already mentioned, I think the book of Esther has a lot to say to us as we can feel like, we're surrounded by all this pagan culture, and it can get really dangerous. Decrees get passed, and it looks like, the game is up. But God delivers His people, and through that, people get converted still somehow. I don't know how that happens. It's like the parable of the growing seed, right? I love that statement there. Night and day it grows, and the guy who plants it, he doesn't know how it works. It's just God somehow makes it grow. That's the way conversion works. There's a colleague of mine, he's actually the assistant pastor at my church. He likes to say that the Old Testament has kind of a come-and-see approach, that we're creating this beautiful sanctuary, beautiful city, with all these glorious laws, and it's the idea is that the nations will see this, they'll kind of gather around it, and they'll be awed by it and give glory to God. So it's sort of a, come here and see how glorious this is, and be affected, be transformed by that. He likes to say Old Testament is kind of come and see, the New Testament is more go and tell, being sent out. And that it can be overstated, but I think there's a truth to that. The New Testament is very definitely go tell others. And I think the book of Esther really is moving in that direction much more than what you would see from other books of the Old Testament. So that's why I think Esther has a lot to say to us in our situation today and in our culture. That's moving very fast. But let me, I'll take as many questions as Bob will allow me to take. Right. That's why I referenced Dr. Rayburn's pulls of Scripture. Both are important. It's just in some situations you kind of lean on one as opposed to the other. It's like, when do you answer the fool according to his folly? When do you not answer the fool according to his folly? Both are true. Sometimes one, sometimes the other. I actually had a note on this. I'm not saying that Ezra and Nehemiah is bad, but I do think that just our situation in our culture as the American church, it's more of an Esther-type diaspora setting, not so much an Ezra and Nehemiah, let's build the holy city sort of situation. I hope that makes sense. Yeah.
Like with a character like David, we see his flaws, but yet God puts his stamp of approval and says he's a man after God's own heart. Speak to the characters in Esther, Mordecai, and Esther.
I like them. The question was, the Bible's heroes, David, or we could think of others, Samson. They're people of faith, godliness, but they're also a mixed bag, and you see a lot of their flaws. I don't think that Esther, the book of Esther, is really trying to bring out the flaws of either Mordecai or Esther. Some people will point to certain things there. I'd probably take a different approach, but read the commentary when it comes out.
No, I was just trying to get certain characters we can glom onto and we can kind of really examine. What kind of approach should we take with these characters in regards to?
Yeah. I'm looking for. Invite me back to talk about that. Because that really, to talk about the characters, that's a fascinating thing, and I have a lot to say about that, that I can't say in 1 minute. So.
I think a lot of recent work in Old Testament, especially with the narratives, show that the author or writer of each book provided a evaluative assessment of the story. And sometimes it takes a lot of skill digging that out. I don't see that in Esther. Can you explain why, especially with a lot of the unsavory things that happen?
Yeah, there's some... Esther, it's a book of sex and violence. I mean, there's crazy stuff that goes on there. The Old Testament's kind of like that, actually. There's some subtle evaluation that goes on, but I would I want to kind of
invite you back.
Yeah, invite me back. I think there are reasons. I think it's trying to focus our attention more on other issues and not so much actually on the characters themselves, because in terms of like literature writing, they're not. This is going to sound impious. They're not very interesting characters. You know, we read a novel and it's like, we want to see character growth and development, and you know, he started as this nasty old man, but then, you know, they found the secret garden and, you know, his heart was warmed by, you know, this little girl who also was started the story nasty, but she, you know, she met old Dickon on the moor, and anyway, kids are reading the secret garden, so. You know, we like that. That's kind of what we look for in literature. Biblical literature is very different in that respect. So you don't see a lot of character development. It tends to focus more on the events and the significance of events. My whole sort of thesis about transforming exile and diaspora, I stole that from a Jewish commentator, John Levinson. So, you know, I'm officially giving him credit here. it was his quote that got me going in this direction. And it's very important in that the development of that concept. If you read Jewish scholars studying the book of Esther, they get into that issue a great deal. You get it elsewhere, But it's very obvious here. And boy, they have a lot of issues with Esther being married to a Gentile. The rabbinic literature on Esther is very fascinating. I'll just say that. Sometimes it's crazy, you know, but very interesting. Because it is such a challenging book in so many ways.
Chance to plug your book. When's it coming out? Is it part of a series?
When's it coming out? I don't know. I'm supposed to have it done about a year or so from now, a year and a half from now. And then however long it takes after that, I don't know. That's if I make my deadline. It's with Zondervan. It's a series, Zondervan Exegetical Commentary on the Old Testament, which, you know, exciting title. I wouldn't say in this case it's God working in spite of his people. Sometimes you get that where, like Judges, you know, here's Samson, spends time with prostitutes, but also delivers God's people. That's clearly working in spite of the hero's flaws. Okay? I think with Esther, there's some room for debate and discussion, you know, how, you know, was she upright? Was she godly? Or was Mordecai upright and godly? I think the narrative is okay with them and what they did. But that's not really the focus. So it's more just God working through them, not necessarily in spite of them or against them or kind of having to work around their flaws. Okay, it's just character issues for Mordecai and Esther are not the main focus of the storyline. It really is God working, orchestrating these circumstances just so remarkably so that the whole domino chain of events works out. Because again, if the king fell asleep that night, then instead of having insomnia, yeah, it's all off and God's people get wiped out. Or if they turn to a different part of the book and didn't read about what Mordecai had done, again, God's people are on the chopping block. Or if Esther, and part of it too is Esther, she goes to visit the king, and he says, "Oh, honey, it's great to see you. What do you want? Even up to half of my kingdom, I'll give it to you." She doesn't say, "Well, thank you for asking, dear. Would you please save my life and the life of my people?" She doesn't say that at first. She says, "Come to my party." you know, come to a party tomorrow, and I'm going to tell you then.
Every woman
understands
that.
And no men do.
Yeah.
Every man appreciates it.
I'm waiting for my party. That's all I'm saying. But it's because she delays giving her request that allows the king to have insomnia. And because that's what happens in the meantime. So again, it's this phenomenal chain of events that only God could have worked it together. So that's getting back to that theme.